This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports on the deaths of aid workers in Gaza.
Gaza medical officials say an Israeli strike killed four foreign aid workers. They work for celebrity chef Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen charity. A Palestinian driver was also killed. The group had just brought in a new shipload of food by a maritime route into Gaza. Footage showed the bodies of the five dead at a hospital in central Gaza. Several of them wore protective gear with the charity's logo. Staff showed the passports of three of the dead, British, Australian, and Polish. The nationality of the fourth aid worker was not immediately known. The Israeli military says a review has started to understand the circumstances of what it calls this tragic incident. I'm Ed Donahue.
Suspected Israeli warplanes bombed Iran's embassy in Syria Monday, and Tehran said seven military advisors were killed, including three senior commanders. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston.
The target, according to Iranian state media, was top Revolutionary Guards commander Mohammad Reza Zahedi. He had been a senior commander in Iran's elite Quds force, the Corps' overseas arm, according to the guards. Iran's ambassador to Syria, Hossein Akbari, said Tehran's response would be harsh. Syria's foreign minister condemned the attack. Its state media cited a military source saying Israel launched the attack from the occupied Golan Heights and that its air defense system shot down some of the missiles. The strike appeared to signal an escalation in Israel's war against Iran's regional proxies.
Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston. Russia's top security agency said Monday that it has broken up what it called a terrorist cell in southern Russia, whose members had provided weapons and cash to suspected attackers of the Moscow Concert Hall. Federal Security Service said that on Sunday it detained four suspected members of the cell. This is VOA News. Heavy gunfire erupted Monday in the downtown area of Haiti's capital as police battled gang members near the National Palace for several hours. Local media report that at least one policeman was shot after he and other officers were forced to flee an armored car that was later set on fire. Scores of people were trapped by the gunfire in downtown Port-au-Prince, while dozens of others managed to flee. The company that owns a ship that crashed into the Key Bridge in Maryland is seeking to cap the company's liability in a new legal filing. AP's Lisa Dwyer tells us more.
The filing seeks to cap the company's liability at roughly $43.6 million. Trial lawyer Enrique Serna says the goal of Synergy and Grace Ocean is to try to limit their legal exposure.
What this does is it stops all litigation. It consolidates it in this one filing.
Serna says that any cap on liability would likely hurt the little guys, such as the immigrants who were killed when the bridge collapsed.
Hopefully we can get across to the families of the immigrants to say, act quick, get on it.
A federal court in Maryland will ultimately decide who is responsible and how much they owe. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Shares of former U.S. President Donald Trump's social media firm plunged on Monday after the company reported a net loss of $58 million last year. Reuters correspondent Lisa Bernard.
The disclosure comes just days after a flashy stock market debut when shares of the parent company of social media platform Truth Social had risen. Trump Media and Technology Group said in a filing that it had generated revenue of just $4.1 million in 2023. It also said management had, quote, substantial doubt the company would have enough money to meet its financial liabilities as they come due. The company, which trades under the ticker symbol DJT, said it expects to incur operating losses and negative cash flows for the foreseeable future as it works to expand its user base and attract more platform partners and advertisers.
A judge has refused to toss out a tax case against Hunter Biden, moving the case closer to the possible spectacle of a trial as his father campaigns for another term as president. U.S. District Judge Mark Scarsi on Monday denied eight motions to dismiss the charges against President Joe Biden's son, a four-year scheme to avoid paying $1.4 million in taxes while living an extravagant lifestyle. Hunter Biden has pleaded not guilty to the nine felony and misdemeanor tax offenses. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today, Tuesday, is Inauguration Day in Senegal, as President-elect Bassirou Diomaye Faye takes the oath of office.
Almost all the head of state of ECOWAS member states will be attending, starting by President Tinubu, who is the chairperson of ECOWAS. We will have also the chairperson of the AU.
UNICEF is urging immediate action to bolster security in hundreds of schools in Nigeria following recent abductions. Maryland governor urges Democrats and Republicans to approve funding for a collapsed bridge. Sierra Leone's main opposition seeks a diplomatic dialogue with the Guinean ambassador in Sierra Leone following the arrest of Abubakar Boxcounter.
We were trying to get a dialogue with the Guinean ambassador so that we can be able to engage the Guinean government to understand where Boxcounter had been detained and also for us to know his status.
And Tel Aviv law plans to shut Al Jazeera in Israel. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today, Tuesday, is Inauguration Day in Senegal as newly elected President Bassirou Diomaye Faye will take the oath of office as the country's fifth president. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken congratulated President-elect Faye on Tuesday and commended the people of Senegal for a peaceful and inclusive election. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahim Akar tells me that almost all leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, and the chairperson of the African Union Commission will attend, signaling the importance of Senegal as a model of democracy in Africa.
It will be a very interesting event because usually the oath of the president is taken at the Constitutional Council, but this time they decided to organize it in the new city called Jamiajo at the Youth Conference Center, which is a bigger place. And the new president will be swearing in front of the seven members of the Constitutional Council. And then after he will be given the sigil sign of the Republic, and then the president of the Constitutional Court will make a speech. And after all of that, the new president will leave that place and go directly to the presidential palace where Macky Sall will be waiting for him. And then in a small ceremony, Macky Sall will be giving him the keys of the presidential palace. And then that's the normal ceremony. And Diomaye Faye will be the sixth president of Senegal. The prime minister of Macky Sall will come and present his resignation. The new president will accept that resignation and then name a new prime minister. The following day, the new president of Senegal, for the first time, will address the nation, and that will be the beginning of his presidency.
Do we have any indication in terms of who are the foreign dignitaries, presidents also, who are going to be attending the inauguration?
Almost all the head of state of ECOWAS member state will be attending, starting by President Tinubu, who is the chairperson of ECOWAS. Today, already four of them arrived in Senegal. Among those, the president of the Gambia, the president of Guinea-Bissau, the president of Sierra Leone. We will have also the chairperson of the AU, the president of Mauritania. Very interestingly, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have sent, like in Burkina Faso, the Speaker of the Parliament. In Mali is also, I think, the Permanent Secretary of the Military Junta, accompanied by the Minister of Foreign Affairs. It means that this ceremony will be also an opportunity for ECOWAS leaders to start informal conversations about the crisis the institution is having. And I think that will be also a very important sign, because since the coup, I don't think that the ECOWAS dignitary has met with Malian, Burkinabe, and Niger officials. So that will be an opportunity. I have also to add that the chairperson of the AU Commission, President Faki, is also in Senegal, and the chairperson of ECOWAS Commission. It's even unprecedented because the swearing-in of the president in Senegal has always been a national normal event, but this time you have many, many dignitaries dignitaries. Last time, I think, when Macky Sall was president, we have 3 or 4 presidents, but this time it's more than 10 presidents who will be attending. It tells you also about the importance of the event in Africa and the fact that Senegal is seen as a model of democracy that needs to be sustained, needs to be protected, and the presence of all these dignitaries.
Of course, the inauguration will mark the climax of this excitement that began building since the release of Ousmane Sonko and Bassirou Diomaye Faye. The work begins following Tuesday's inauguration. The expectations also build. One asks, is he going to be ready?
Well, he has to be ready. And I think that's why Senegalese are really, really waiting for his first speech. And I think that first speech will outline at least the key action that he wants to take in the first, let's say, 200 days.
Ibrahim Akan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. The Democratic Republic of Congo's planning minister, Judith Suminwa Tuluka, was Monday appointed as the African nation's first woman prime minister, according to the state television. According to the French news agency AFP, Tuluka, an economist, takes over as prime minister from Jean-Michel Sama Lukonde, following President Félix Tshisekedi's sweeping re-election on December 20. The new prime minister will be tasked with pushing the president's declared priorities of employment, youth, women, and national cohesion for the nation of about 100 million people. UNICEF is urging immediate action to boost security in hundreds of schools in Nigeria following recent abductions for ransom of dozens of students in the northern part of the country. President Bola Tinubu said his administration is poised to implement a safe school policy to keep children safe in schools countrywide. Abubakar Mohammed is a security analyst. He tells VOA's Chinedu Ofor the government lacks the political will and manpower to tackle what he calls a national security failure.
Kidnappings of school children in Zamfara, in Kaduna, in Kaduna, and now IDPs in Borno. And there are many cases of kidnap in the city of Abuja that go on unreported. Families just gather together, raise money, and they pay, and they keep quiet. Same thing with the Southeast. I don't think the Nigerian government is really serious about that.
If the president carries out this policy, what are the likely problems he's likely to face?
Number one, I don't think they have enough manpower to man those schools. Number two, the proponent of this very criminality are the bandits. They are still out there at large. The government is still unable to tackle this issue of those bandits. So long as those bandits have a free ride in the bushes and they collaborate with their cell in town, they would still do this kidnapping. The government would not be able to do anything. Just last week, the government said they will not pay ransom to get school children that were kidnapped in Kaduna. We've just been told over $1 billion was paid. So these are some of the challenges he will meet, he will encounter. I talk about lack of enough manpower, boots on ground. Talk about the bandits who are coordinating this thing, who are planning, executing it. They are there at large in the bushes. And the government apparently still doesn't know what to do. The issue of lack of coordination between the Nigerian Security and Civil Defense Corps, the police, the military, the intelligence, there is no coordination, there is no synergy. Then the schools, the perimeter fencing of those schools, you just go, you see, you know, from the school you can move into the bush.
If, as you say, the government lacks the capacity to carry out this policy, why do you think the president is throwing this out there, this plan of securing schools?
To give Nigerians hope. The way with the plan, the strategy, I don't see any. I can bet you they don't even have accurate statistics of public schools, boarding houses, day schools, or whatever in Nigeria. They don't have it. If the president said that, I believe he just said it to give hope to Nigerians, but it doesn't mean if they really want to do it, they cannot do it. But I don't think at the moment they are serious about it, the will to do it.
The government appears to be blaming parents and victims of this kidnapping, claiming that if they keep paying, then the kidnappers will keep picking up people, picking up children, and even picking up individuals off the streets because ransom will be paid.
I am on the side of the government on this issue. Payment of ransom in whatever form it perpetuate criminality, and it will embolden, keep on enticing the criminals to keep on kidnapping school children, because they know at the end money will be paid.
That's security analyst Abubakar Mohammed in Abuja speaking with viewers Chinedu Ofowo. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Sierra Leone's main opposition All People's Congress, the APC party, has requested a diplomatic dialogue with the Guinean ambassador in Sierra Leone for information on party member Abubakar Box Conte. He was arrested a week ago at the Guinea airport in a joint operation with Guinea and Sierra Leonean security. Sierra Leone Information Minister Chernel Barr told VOA that Box Conte was arrested on suspicion of involvement with the November 26, 2023 alleged coup attempt and trafficking of the drug Kush. Lansana Dumbuya is the National Security Secretary General of the APC. He tells me that the purpose of the diplomatic dialogue is to appeal to the Guinea to ensure that the rights and freedom of Conte, who is also the regional coordinator of the opposition APC party, are protected.
We heard about the arrest of Box, but up to now, we've not been able to identify where he's been detained. Initially, we were told that he was arrested in Guinea. Later on, the Sierra Leone Information Minister put out a public notice informing the general populace in Sierra Leone that, in fact, Ibrahim Box Conte had been arrested by the Guinean authorities, and they are in contact with the Guinean authorities for him to be extradited to Sierra Leone. So we wrote directly condemning the act, and we were trying to get a dialogue with the Guinean ambassador so that we can be able to engage the Guinean government to understand where Box Conte had been detained, and also for us to know his status in detention, and for us to get to know exactly why has he been arrested, why has he been detained, and why has he not been allow access to solicitors. We just wanted to follow the process and make sure that he gets legal representation so that we're able to follow the process.
So what would you like for the ambassador to do?
Well, firstly, we want the ambassador to tell us exactly where Box Conte is being detained so that he can be able to get access to the legal representation we've already provided. We have made the provision there in Guinea. The lawyer cannot access Ibrahim Box Conte. Whatever we do here, the government in Guinea is keeping it a secrecy, which they should not do, even if you assume for once that somebody, you know, has committed a crime. It's not secret. You have to make everything available to him, the rights available to him. So we want him to contact the authorities there to tell us where Ibrahim Box Conte has been detained. I think that is the proper thing to do for any responsible government. When we're able to know where he is, then we take it from there.
As you know, the Sierra Leone government has accused Mr. Conte of involvement in the alleged coup d'etat that took place in Sierra Leone, and also of drug trafficking. What's your reaction to these allegations?
Well, as far as we know, and as far as we have contacted the families of Ibrahim Box Conte, he's not been involved, and he's somebody who hates drugs completely, so that is really like something funny in the ears of the family, and for us also who know Ibrahim Box Conte. So if at all, assuming for once that is true, the Guinean authorities are supposed to be able, because he's in Guinea, they are supposed to be able to investigate to know whether indeed this is true. With regards to the coup, sir, you know, we all know that when somebody is involved in a coup, it's no secret. The investigation was done, and we know that there was a report from the investigation. You should be aware of that. And not for once was Ibrahim Box Conte mentioned in the report. And during the preliminary of the investigation, they put notices out of fugitives, those who are involved and whatnot. Those periods, Ibrahim Box Conte was going in and out of the country to Guinea, because that's where his family resides.
Lassana Dumbuya is the National Secretary General of Sierra Leone's main opposition All People's Congress Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. Israel passed a law that paves the way to shutting down a foreign media network operating in Israel if it is seen to be harming national security. Linda Greystar reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The Israeli press is calling it the Al Jazeera law, as it is aimed primarily against the Qatar-based satellite news network that has a global reach of about 430 million homes. Israeli Communications Minister Shlomo Karchi welcomed the passage of the law, saying there will be no freedom of speech for what he called Hamas's mouthpiece in Israel. He said that Al Jazeera will be closed in the coming days. VOA reached out to the Al Jazeera office in Israel, which did not wish to comment. The law gives the government temporary power to prevent media networks from operating in Israel if they harm national security. Israel can close the channel's Israel office, confiscate its equipment, and order its website to be taken offline if the server is located in Israel. Under the terms of the law, any order to shut down a foreign news channel must be brought within 24 hours for judicial review by the president of a district court, who must decide within 3 days if he wants to shut the station for 45 days or fewer. After the law was approved, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on X, "Al Jazeera will no longer be broadcast from Israel. I intend to act immediately in accordance with the new law to stop the channel's activity." Israeli officials say Al Jazeera has basically functioned as a mouthpiece for Hamas militants. On a recent broadcast, Meirav Leshem Gonen, the mother of 23-year-old hostage Romy Gonen, pleaded for her daughter's release. The host of the program repeatedly interrupted her, asking if she had proof that Hamas had murdered anyone on October 7th, when swarms of Hamas gunmen killed 1,200 Israelis, including hundreds at a music party, and kidnapped more than 240 others. The new law is controversial outside Israel, and White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said the U.S. is concerned.
We believe in the freedom of the press. It is critical. It is critically important, and the United States supports the critically important work journalists around the world do. And that includes those who are reporting in the conflict in Gaza. So we believe that work is important, the freedom of the press is important, and if those reports are true, it is concerning to us.
The Committee to Protect Journalists said the law poses a significant threat to the international media and contributes to a climate of self-censorship and hostility toward the press. The committee said the trend has escalated since the start of the Israel-Hamas war almost 6 months ago. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
With efforts underway to clean up thousands of tons of steel debris from the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore's harbor, Maryland Governor Wes Moore urged Republicans to work with Democrats to approve the federal funding needed for rebuilding it and to get the port economy back on its feet. President Joe Biden, who is scheduled to visit Baltimore Friday, has pledged that the federal government will cover the cost of rebuilding the bridge, which could cost as much as $2 billion. VOA's Ken Lewis spoke with John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, about whether a divided Congress can come together to authorize funds for the rebuilding of the bridge.
Maryland Governor Wes Moore urged Republicans to work with Democrats to approve the federal funding needed for rebuilding the Francis Scott Key Bridge and to get the port economy back on its feet. Do you see this happening with Republicans and Democrats?
Well, I do think in the wake of some sort of emergency, there does tend to be funding that comes in to help in an emergency. There may be some grumbling from one side or the other, but I suspect at the end of the day, there will be significant federal dollars to help rebuild the bridge in Baltimore.
And also, President Biden is scheduled to visit Baltimore this Friday, and he's already pledged that the federal government will cover the cost. But, of course, that will depend on passage of legislation authorizing the funds by both parties, the Republican-led House of Representatives and the Democratic-led Senate. So, again, with Biden coming to Baltimore, I guess it's a show of his sincerity, but it also is an election year.
The president is someone who can react more quickly in emergencies, and for the president to show up in a place and to indicate that there will be some federal support is usually a good sign for the country, but it's also something that could help a president's popularity. But you're right that the longer-term appropriations and, of course, the rebuilding of the bridge will take many years, and that will require some sort of congressional authorization. I expect at the end of the day that there will be that authorization of money. There may be small arguments over the way in which it's spent and the formulas and the percentages, but the grumbling that we may hear now is unlikely to last, and in an emergency, infrastructure difficulties like the one we've had are likely to resolve with the federal money coming in to help rebuild that bridge.
Yes, and also there are approximately 15,000 jobs at stake in the Port of Baltimore, people who work there. Will lawmakers take this into consideration, the people aspect of it?
I think it's part of the equation. This is not something that will happen very quickly. The bridge will not be rebuilt in a month or a day or a year. But there are also, of course, other alternatives for different shipping lanes and other mitigation methods that they'll likely use as well. So I think it's part of the equation for why we fund on an emergency basis after tragedies happen. But I think ultimately the parties will come together, and there will likely be money for that bridge that will be built over a number of years.
John Fortier is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He spoke with viewers Ken Lewis. At least 23 people were killed during late March clashes between herders and farmers in a region of southern Chad that frequently sees similar land disputes, Chad's communication minister told AFP on Monday. The minister said the fighting was set off by the assassination of a nomadic Arab-speaking herder and raged between March 17 and 21 in three villages in the southern fertile region of Moyen Chere. The AFP said relatives and clan members of the dead man, who are based in the drier north of the country, led a punitive raid in the village they believe was responsible for the ambush that led to his death. The minister said calm had returned on Monday. The clashes, which lasted for 7 days and spread to two other villages, resulted in 9 deaths among the Arab herders and 14 from the local Sarakaba people, including 4 women and 2 children. In eastern and southern Chad, where many residents are armed, clashes frequently break out as sedentary farmers accuse herders of allowing animals to graze on their land or trample crops. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
Practices such as female genital mutilation or forced marriage are well known, most people may not be aware of breast ironing, a practice where young girls have their breasts flattened to deter unwanted male attention. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will discuss why certain communities carry out such a painful practice. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-Minute VOA Newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.